More on digging into how we think on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is my co-host, Vice Chairman of the Institute, fellow analyst, good friend, and presuppositional thinker, Chuck Michaelis.
That's right, and I presuppose that it's good that we're back together in the studio today.
And I believe we presuppose that everybody who was listening yesterday are back today listening for more of what we've been talking about, learning how to think in a way that gets to the root of the issue.
And we're going to come into one of the reasons why it's absolutely necessary for us to think presuppositionally as we go into this. We can't presuppose, though, that everybody necessarily heard yesterday's show. So we're going to start out with a little reiteration of what we started with. We gave a little rundown on what presuppositionalism is. You're going to have to go back for that. But we'll start again with we're going into what an invalid presupposition looks like. And we started out with a story that basically says that abortion is up to 17 times safer than a full-term birth. We asked the question from a presuppositional basis, safer for whom? And the answer is, the word safer is an equivocation. It's the use of an equivocation fallacy, because we pointed out yesterday that a minimum of 50% of the people involved in an abortion die, whereas a very small percentage of the people who have a birth or have an abortion are maimed or killed. So the word safer has a lot of presuppositional baggage attached. As we talked about yesterday, the implication is that fewer people are harmed or killed by abortion than in full-term birth, but there are implications based on invalid presuppositions, and that is that no human lives are lost during an abortion. That's kind of where we left off. There are two major underlying presuppositions to that presupposition.
Yes, there are.
And as we said yesterday, all presuppositions have underlying presuppositions. And what we're going to look at today is what those underlying presuppositions are and what the problems are with them. The two major ones possible that I came up with, and you may come up with more, Barry, I'm not sure, but the first one that I looked at was that the fetus is not a human life, but is quote-unquote potential life.
Well, even the U.S. Supreme Court has changed their thinking on that, and they've presupposed that instead of using the term potential life, they actually are now using living human fetus or living human being from the moment of detectable heartbeat. It's actually finding a fact in the Stenberg versus Carhart case coming out of 2007. So I know that the popular death culture is still trying to post it that way.
Okay, this is something about presuppositional thinking that often is a problem, and that is it takes time for the presuppositions to change.
Yes, yes it does.
And this is one of those places where the presupposition has been wrong for years, and we're going to get into that in a little bit. But basically, if it's not a human life but potential life, then the rights of humanity don't attach.
And we've seen that. As a matter of fact, that's part of the reason why we've got a pushback now. And I'm sure a lot of the listeners in this listening audience know about the personhood amendment that's being
right.
Petitions are being circulated right now. And, you know, I want to say, just for the record, Chuck, we support the idea.
Absolutely.
And we're praying and hoping that it's very successful as one of a number of strategies of ending the culture of death here in Ohio. But that's the thing that they're running up against, is that there's a presupposition
right.
that if we talk about potentiality of life and we don't understand that life begins at conception, at the moment that you have, or fertilization, where the sperm and the egg meet and everything starts happening, we end up insulating ourselves from that.
One of the problems they're running into, even in states like Mississippi, where the presupposition that human beings have the right to life is very strong, are those presuppositions that people have absorbed and don't realize they've absorbed yet. They don't think consciously presuppositionally, which is something that I know you and I both try to do, and sometimes it's hard.
It is difficult at times, because part of your presuppositions, especially when you're, well, I should say, a mature adult like we are, and I don't mean that in our intellect, I just mean that in our age, but but when you're a mature adult like us, the problem is that our presuppositions have been built over years and decades of all the influences from our parents, from our teachers, from the media that we've consumed, from those thoughts that we've allowed to uncritically be planted in our heads by our culture. All of those things add up But the point is that ultimately we are supposed to, as you said in the last program, we are to be renewing our mind, right, putting on the mind of Christ as believers. Because it's not just a heart change, ladies and gentlemen. Salvation is not a heart change only. It is an entire world and life view change. It's, as an old friend of mine used to say, change your stinking thinking.
Yeah.
And God bless him, because he's out fighting the good fight in New Jersey right now against gay marriage. But the whole point is that we have a duty to seek to put on the mind of Christ, to bring every thought captive,
right,
to the obedience of Christ. That's when you're getting down to presuppositions.
And this is why, for instance, since I've become a presuppositional thinker, I've chosen to homeschool my children, because who can instill my children with the mind of Christ? Me or a public school who pretends that there's neutrality in the area of religion?
Oh, now you've run the flag up the flagpole, okay, my friend. Here we go.
And I'm going to actually walk away from it, and we can come back to that at a different time.
We're going
to
have to, because yeah, you used that nasty N-word.
I know. But the fact is, I'm going to ask you a question. What are the rights of humanity, Barry? And where do we find them?
Well, a lot of our friends would point to the Declaration of Independence, right, and say, look, it says we're endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Problem is, it's the words "among these" that you have to think about, and the fact that, oh, that means our Creator endowed us with more rights. Wait a minute, life, liberty, happiness, did we do that? No, wait a minute, where did our Creator tell us we had these rights? Oh, the Bible. That's where our rights are.
Yes. That's a hard thing for Christians to understand. I'm going to run another one up the flagpole, and that's partly because we have a lot of people who are delving into the radical two kingdoms theology, which basically says, well, yeah, we don't know for sure whether the job of government is actually to protect those rights or not. And again, I'm going to walk away from that, because we'll deal with that on another set of shows. But
so, in other words, you're tiptoeing near the third rail every time. Here.
I'm doing this in the interest of time.
Yes, I know.
Unfortunately, we've only got a limited amount of time here. That we can't even do that on a Saturday. We'd have to do that on a series of Saturdays.
Well, I know.
Okay. Now, those questions that we asked, if the fetus is not a human life but a potential life, which we reject, and the rights of humanity do not attach, that in itself raises questions.
It does.
First of all, at what point does the fetus become no longer potential but is fully vested with the rights of humans?
The big problem with that is it's arbitrary.
Uh-huh.
It's up to either medical professionals to decide when life begins. It may be up to legislatures to decide when life begins and have a floating scale.
Okay.
Is it viability? Is it heartbeat? Is it... Well, we're not really sure until the baby comes out. Are you a Peter Singer advocate and says, oh, well, you know, up until the 2 to 3 years old, when they actually have self-awareness, are they really a human being?
So-called self-awareness, yeah. Of course, I actually got to the same conclusion, but I went by a little more circuitous route. And that is, I asked another question. Viability, what is it exactly?
Ah, well, see, that's where an outside source, whether it be a medical professional, et cetera, determines, which is horribly subjective. I'm sorry.
It's a cult of expert. We've talked about the cult of experts.
What I call the myth of the professional.
Right.
The cult of the experts deciding that at point X, that fetus, because they're never going to call it a child at that point, that fetus can, quote unquote, survive outside the womb.
Okay. That brings up more questions, believe it or not.
Here we go.
Okay, that's one of the things. What is it exactly, the ability to survive outside the womb, perhaps? When exactly is that?
Well, that's a sliding scale, because if you look at various legislatures have put it at some at 21 weeks, some at 22, some at 24.
That gets to my next question. Is the number of weeks statistically supportable?
No.
Okay.
We got to unpack it just slightly, Chuck.
Okay. That brings me to the next question.
Okay. Keep going. All right.
If not, what is the acceptable percentage of survivors to properly define viability?
Now we're playing God.
Bingo.
And there's the problem right there. When you start unpacking this, you start realizing that the base presupposition is who is in control?
All right.
Is it man? Through his myth of the professional and the practicing physician, or is it God who says that life begins I knew you in your mother's womb.
I knit you together, before I knew you before the foundations of the earth. Yeah. Now let me. Here's a fourth question. Okay, is it birth? Now refer back to the viability question. Why birth and not viability?
Well, again, it's changing your stinking thinking. I guess is what we get down to. See, this kind of brings up a quick little tangent. We all celebrate birthdays, so we're all already conditioning ourselves and our next generations to presuppose that it's the point of birth that you become a human being, even though many of us believe more of that. I understand that it's Hallmark doesn't make happy conception day cards.
Well, let me ask you a question. That's interesting you say that. Do you know how old you are if you're Chinese on your first birthday?
You are.
Or on your birthday? You are born one year old.
Yes. That's right. You're born a year old.
Right.
That's right. So, but the point is that, you know, I just got through celebrating one, and I'm not going to tell you how old I am. Yeah. But the point is that got me to stop and think. You know, honestly, if I truly am going to be consistent with my presuppositions that life begins at the moment of conception or fertilization, then for me to celebrate my age as being the point of my birth, I'm being a hypocrite. I'm actually approximately 36 weeks or 9 months or so older than I really am. Than I'm really perceived to be.
This way of thinking about birthdays is way older than the abortion culture. So,
we've had them both around for a long time.
Way older than the abortion culture. Let me bring up a point, and you may want to unpack after this, but sure. The more questions you have to ask, the more arbitrary the definition is. And the arbitrariness really has no place in the discussion of the definition of human life.
It can't. Because at the point that you allow the arbitrary, subjective criteria to play a role, you're playing God.
What would you say if I made the statement that arbitrariness destroys the presupposition's usefulness, not to mention the coherency of the entire question?
I believe that to be absolutely true, because that is the method that I actually use when I'm engaging people in a presuppositional apologetic way. I'm going after their presuppositions. I'm taking them down to the base core. And if they're arbitrary, that core doesn't stand. It doesn't hold, because I always say, if you really want to get somebody, you get them down to what they truly believe, right in the core, and then you take them the other direction to the logical outworkings of their belief system. It's not too comfortable for most people.
No, it's not. It's very. In fact, what you'll usually get is an angry reaction.
You will most likely get an angry reaction.
You need to be prepared for that. And a lot of Christians have gotten into this goofy idea that confrontation is bad. No, unprepared confrontation is bad. If you are prepared to deal and say, look, I'm not doing this to make you mad. I'm doing this to find out how you are thinking. And the fact is, one thing you have to point out to people is that incoherency in an argument, and then let's face the facts, these arbitrary viability, life begins at birth, all these are incoherent.
Yes.
I can speak as a trained scientist, trained in biological sciences with some training in embryology. Not much, but some. The fact that I knew from the minute that I began to study the science that the beginning of life was the moment that the DNA recombined.
Yes.
You may have heard of recombinant DNA technology, because recombination is a new and unique life. God works in mysterious ways, and I can tell you that biologists really don't understand recombination. And I'm not sure, don't want to make a statement that's blanket, but I'm not sure they ever will completely understand recombination, because that's how you get your mom's chin and your dad's nose.
Uh-huh.
And your grandpa's ears, and how I inherited my hairline, my rapidly becoming non-existent hairline. But these are questions that bring you to the point of where the person really stands. And believe me, when you dynamite the not-so-rock-solid, in fact, built-upon-sand foundations of their argument, they almost always react with anger.
Well, but Charles, honestly... And I know, because we've been indoctrinated in a Christian culture to say that we're supposed to be loving and kind and meek and gentle. Point is, we're dealing with truth.
Right.
We're dealing with how you think and how that has consequences.
Yes.
Because we know ideas have consequences. When somebody gets mad, at least I've got them thinking. That is a positive sign. And we'll go into more of that tomorrow.
Yes, and unfortunately, again, we're out of time. You know, these discussions go really fast. Join us again tomorrow for another Principles and Policies.